Welcome, everyone. I'm Marilyn Stern, Middle East Forum board member serving as chair. Today we welcome Mr. Ilan Berman, Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington, D.C., and expert on regional security in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Russian Federation. A former consultant to the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. Department of Defense, Mr. Berman is the author most recently of Iran's Deadly Ambition, The Islamic Republic's Quest for Global Power. Our topic is Russia's expanding influence in the Middle East, in particular Russia's military intervention in Syria. President Putin, responding to U.S. criticism of Russian airstrikes, said, "Some of our partners have mush for brains. They don't have a clear understanding of what's happening on Syrian territory." To help us understand the regional implications of Putin's Middle Eastern goals, we'll now hear from Ilan Berman. Ilan?
Oh, thank you, Marilyn. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me. My time is limited, so I thought what I would do is to try to give a little bit of insight into how Vladimir Putin and his coterie, his followers, are looking at the Middle East strategically and also the functions that Russia is trying to fulfill through its intervention in Syria, because they're not necessarily the same things. First, I think it's useful to start with an understanding that what Russia is trying to do is it's trying to kill many birds with one stone with its Syria intervention. There is a dominant theme that runs through a lot of discourse, certainly here in the United States, over the last several weeks about Russia's intervention that casts it almost in a bilateral U.S.-Russian light, as in Russia's gain is our loss, and Russia is able to do the things that it's doing because of the administration's weakness, its fecklessness, its inability to articulate a Middle East strategy. That's true, I think, as far as it goes, but the Russian perspective, I think, is much broader. It's not just that Putin and the Kremlin are being opportunistic. They're also trying to achieve at least four strategic objectives. The first and the most obvious is that they're trying to prop up the Assad regime. This is, I think, very clear from both official rhetoric. Vladimir Putin said as much in a recent interview with Charlie Rose, but also through the type of military deployment that Russia is engaging in. Essentially, it's a military deployment that is intended to provide air cover and battleground support for the Alawite enclave that serves as Bashar al-Assad's source of political support and stability in the west of the country, in the west of Syria. But here I think it's useful to point out that the Russians have a long memory. And what they remember, I think, very well from the preceding decade was how profoundly they were disadvantaged in the in the fallout from the overthrow of Saddam Hussein's regime. Russia, of course, was a key and longtime patron of Saddam Hussein's regime, and as a result, they found themselves systematically shut out of business relations, commercial dealings, national politics by Saddam Hussein's successors of varying political stripes. And as a result, I think what the Russians are trying to do is they're trying to certainly prop up Assad, but at least part of this is to try to preclude the possibility that they'll be profoundly disadvantaged in Syria. And this, I think, leads naturally to the second objective they're trying to achieve. Russia, in a very visceral way, ideologically, sees itself as a great power. And a prerequisite for being a great power is having the ability and maintaining the ability to project power globally. And here, Syria plays a very important role. Since the early 1970s, as part of its unfolding, then very new, but since then unfolding and durable relationship with the regime of Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, the Soviet Union hammered out a basing arrangement under which the Syrian port city of Tartus became the home port for Russia's Mediterranean flotilla. The port of Tartus is now at least partially in peril of falling. Certainly, if the Alawite enclave falls, Russia will lose its grip on the port city of Tartus. And what Russia is doing, in part, is structuring its deployment in such a way as to have its naval presence strengthened, and second base, the air base that the Russians are building to the north of Tartus and Latakia, is, I think, geographically intended to provide air cover for the Mediterranean flotilla as well as for Assad's forces. So in this way, Russia is attempting to maintain its ability to project power into the eastern Mediterranean, much in keeping with the way it sees itself as being a regional player. The third component, which I think is lost amid a lot of the commentary, is the fact that Russia is doing a lot of things in Syria because it's not doing a lot of things elsewhere. And here, you have to take a look at what's happened over the last 6 to 8 weeks, very surprisingly, on the Russian battlefield closer to home, along the common border between Russia and Ukraine. So since February of last year, Russia's engaged in a very extensive military buildup on its common border with Ukraine, and also an extensive campaign of subversion, which entails not only political and economic subversion, but also the outfitting, equipping, and mobilizing of pro-Russia separatists in Ukraine's east, in the region that's commonly known as the Donbass. But that isn't going very well. And over the last 6 to 8 weeks, much to Ukraine's own surprise, Ukrainian forces have managed to fight these separatist forces to a standstill, have raised the cost of escalation to the Kremlin. And so what you see is a slowing Russian pace of military action on the Ukrainian front. And what's happening in Syria is at least part of the equation is that it's an attempt by Russia to regain the momentum. It's also an attempt by Russia to reconfigure the way the United States and Europe, the countries that are sanctioning the Kremlin, think about Russia. So Russia right now, through the lens of Ukraine, is seen as a strategic liability. But more and more, Russia hopes, at least, that through its intervention in Syria, taking up the standard of being the West champion in the fight against the Islamic State terrorist group, Russia hopes that it can improve its position and improve its appearance in the eyes of the West, leading to greater political freedom of action, a lessening of sanctions, and a greater reintegration of Russia into the global community. It's not clear that that's going to happen, but that's clearly, from Russian official statements, something that they're thinking about as an ancillary benefit of what they're doing. And finally, and I think most importantly, is an issue that gets talked about probably the least, which is how what Russia is doing plays into Russia's own war on terror, if you could call it that, Russia's own struggle with radical Islam. Because, you know, the old axiom that all politics are local plays very well in this medium as well. Russia is, for very good reason, extremely apprehensive over the spread of radical Islam in the Middle East and the potential ramifications that this has for Russia's own Muslim minority. One of the reasons for this is demographics. Russia's Muslim minority is growing at a much faster rate than the rest of Russia's population. Russia's Muslims make up roughly 16% of the overall Russian population currently, but positive birth rates and birth rates that are far more robust than those of the rest of the country put them on track to account for 20% by the end of this decade. So the Russians are looking at a minority that is increasingly growing in size, but also in political salience and political activism. It's also a minority that is radicalizing, in part because of the ultra-nationalist identity that Vladimir Putin has propounded for his citizenry, but also because you're seeing more and more penetration of radical Islamic ideas within the borders of the Russian Federation. A good external metric of this is the fact that the Islamic State terrorist group has as its newest adherent a group called the Caucasus Emirate. This is Russia's most potent jihadi group. This is a group that was previously affiliated with al-Qaeda, but which over the summer switched allegiance and now declared formal bayat to the Islamic State. So the Russians sort of feel very keenly the potential of the Islamic State's expanding power to threaten them directly. And there's a second issue here, which is, I think, is very important, which is that the contingent of potential foreign, potential Russian Muslim fighters that the Russian security services are dealing with has actually swelled exponentially. A year ago, Russia's security services were publicly estimating that there were 800 Russian national extremists that had gone to fight and join the ranks of the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. Last month, when the FSB put out their formal assessment of this trend, that number had tripled to 2,400. So what Russia is doing, in part, is sort of putting into practice the old axiom that the best defense is a good offense. Russia is, in many ways, fighting foreign fighters, including its own foreign fighters, in Syria, so it doesn't have to fight them back home. And this, I think, at least partially explains why Russia has been so eager to cast this as a global coalition fight against the Islamic State. For the couple of remaining minutes that I have, it's useful, I think, to point out that for the Russians, this is not a done deal. This is not a slam dunk. This is actually a very complicated endeavor, and it's one that carries a lot of downsides for the Kremlin. First of all, the type of military engagement that Vladimir Putin has talked about, the deployment of 150,000 troops to augment Syrian forces and augment Iranian forces, is simply not sustainable, given the types of military deployments Russia has in the Russian Far East, opposite China, also the buildup on the border with Ukraine, and so on. So Putin has promised a lot, but it's not at all clear that he can deliver militarily. The second is that this deployment has the potential to create a lot of additional economic hardship for Russia at home, in particular because of the dislocation in the natural gas sector, in the energy sector that's going to result. Last year, as the aftermath of Russia's annexation of Crimea and Russia's aggression against Ukraine, the countries of Eastern Europe formally suspended work on a natural gas project called South Stream, which was intended to bring Russian natural gas to Eastern European markets and from there to Central Europe and Western Europe. As a substitute, the Russians have hit upon this idea of doing the same thing via Turkey through a project called Turkish Stream. But the Turks are decidedly not friends of the Assad regime, and as a result of what Russia has done over the last several weeks, the Turks have frozen any discussion or implementation of Turkish Stream, and they've done so indefinitely, and it's not at all clear that this is a project that's going to be revived. So the potential economic downside from this for the Russians is measured not just in the expenditures on the military deployment, but also in potential net revenue that they're going to lose as a result of not having an outlet for their energy stores. And finally, what Russia is doing externally to fight terrorism could have a pretty significant blowback effect, and I would make the argument that you're actually already beginning to see it. In response to Russian intervention in Syria, groups like Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State have all called for terrorist attacks within the Russian Federation, and by all accounts, this is having an effect. Yesterday, today, the Russian government has been talking about the number of terrorist attacks that it has thwarted in the last year. According to the official tally, which is almost assuredly smaller than the unofficial tally, the Russian government has successfully prevented 20 terrorist attacks so far this year, suicide terrorist attacks, bombings, etc. But notable in that context is the fact that two of those attacks were thwarted in the last 2 weeks, which suggests a quickening of the pace of the terrorist threat that's arrayed against Russia. And much of this is because Russia is now exposed in Syria, and there is a desire on the part of jihadi groups to punish Russia for its intervention. So what this leads to is a scenario in which Russia's victory is not assured. What is very clear is that Russia is in it for the long haul. There's no danger of Russia leaving the Syrian front anytime soon, but the potential downsides are huge, potentially culminating in a scenario in which Russia finds itself embroiled in something resembling a new Afghanistan. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Ilan. We're going to have Q&A till 4:30, and I believe we have someone in the queue. Bonnie, if you could give the instructions.
Thank you. The question and answer period will now begin, and we invite your participation. Please note that when there are no questions in the queue, the moderator will ask a question. To join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you wish to identify yourself when your line has been unmuted, please do so. Please remember, if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. Again, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And we have our first caller, so we'll take that question now. Caller, if you wish to identify yourself, please do so when your line is unmuted.
Thank you, Mr. Berman. My name is David. My name is David Kudish, and I live in Aspen, in Miami. My question is regarding the recent attempts of Russia to thwart American sanctions by joining with Iran and China and trying to set up a multi-currency petrodollar base, or the removal of the dollar from petrodollar, from sale of hydrocarbon, oil and gas. With the ruble being unstable and with the renminbi being more free-floating, and the Iranian currency, which had been in a free fall, is probably now recovering, do you see this as a move likely to hurt the U.S. and a move likely to succeed?
Well, thank you. So I think those are two separate things, and I think it's useful to point out by way of sort of an early response is that it's not a new idea. The Russians and the Chinese for years have been talking about sort of decoupling from the U.S. dollar as an exchange currency. I am advisedly not an economist, so my understanding of this is limited, as I think for some of the other members who are on the call as well. But I could point out that what I think is happening is that Russia's economic schemes, and it's not clear that this is a Russian origin economic scheme or a Chinese fomented scheme, but Russia's economic schemes generally haven't been successful, at least in the recent past, due to the lackluster nature of the Russian economy. A great example of this is the Eurasian Economic Union, which has been an idea that's been kicked around for a long time, but one that over the last 2 years, Vladimir Putin has really taken on as his own. And the idea here is to create a sort of a Eurasian counterweight to the European Union and bind the economies of Kazakhstan and Belarus and Armenia and other countries together. But notably, this is a very rickety economic structure. The Russian economic model is not one you necessarily want to tether your national economy to. So I think while there is aspiration, there is certainly a desire very much in keeping with the Russian national identity as Vladimir Putin is defining it to break free of the U.S. dollar, of U.S. influence, I think it's not at all clear, given what's happening with the Russian economy, that this is a really advisable move either for the Chinese or for the Iranians right now. I think it remains to be seen.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll take the next question now. Caller, if you wish to identify yourself, please do so when your line is unmuted.
Johanna Markind, thank you very much for the presentation. My question also concerns Iran. It seems to me that if Russia is trying to deal with this problem of Islamic radicalism, Iran is kind of a dicey partner, and I wonder if you could speculate on what kind of terms it might have reached with Iran. For instance, would you speculate that Iran has made a commitment to Russia that it won't preach its own version of Islamism to Muslims in Russia?
Right. Well, I think that's a great question, and I think it's actually the answer to that threat is back a lot further than the current cooperation that you're seeing in Syria. The collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s unleashed a wave of very sort of destabilizing or potentially destabilizing Islamic separatism throughout Russia's soft underbelly, Russia's southern rim, which is now known as Central Asia. And very quickly thereafter, you saw the Iranians begin to get involved. Most directly, Iran played a key role in the civil war that raged in Tajikistan between 1993 and 1995. And I think this was very much a cautionary moment for the Russians. The Russians understood that if there was an engagement. If they didn't draw the Iranians closer, the Iranians had the potential to do similar things in places they care about more. For example, in the North Caucasus, in places like Chechnya and Dagestan, that the Russians were not willing to let go, so were not willing to secede from the Russian Federation. So I think that the Faustian bargain that emerged as a result was that the Russians provided Iran with first conventional arms, which eventually became a nuclear trade as well, in exchange and political support, in exchange for Iran agreeing to steer clear of this type of destabilizing activity in areas that Russia cared about. And I think you're beginning to see that as well in Syria currently. Russia worries about the Islamic State in part because 98% of Russia's Muslims are Sunni. So Iran doesn't really pose a very compelling narrative for Russia's Muslims, but the Islamic State might. And if Iran and Russia find common cause in fighting this Sunni threat, so much the better. And I think that's really interesting. The interesting thing to watch for me over time has been just sort of grasping how counterintuitive this is from a Russian Muslim perspective. Because if Russia's Muslims are overwhelmingly Sunni, the type of outreach that Iran that Russia is doing to countries like Iran, to Syria, is overwhelmingly focused on Shiite regimes. And this creates no sort of no small sense of dissatisfaction among Russia's own Muslims. But finally, and this is, I think, useful to point out, there is a very good argument to be made that the Russians don't really care about Iran. They cooperate with Iran, but they don't really care about Iran. Certainly not as much as they care about their near abroad, the what they consider their geopolitical backyard of the Caucasus in Central Asia. And I think the Russians understand very well that West, a NATO alliance that's busy putting out fires in the Middle East, is going to be far less likely to intervene in Russia's geopolitical backyard. And so a lot of what it's doing with Iran, also with Syria, is to, in, at least in part, driven by the desire to have greater freedom of action closer to home.
Thank you.
Okay, just a reminder to everyone that if you wish to ask a question, press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. And we do have another caller. So, caller, if you wish to identify yourself, please do so when your line is unmuted.
Hi. Thank you. This is Janet Derflinger. Could you please tell us where Israel fits into all this, particularly in light of the Iran deal?
Sure, sure. So I think that's a great question, and I think all of you saw how quickly Prime Minister Netanyahu made a point of traveling to Moscow to engage in deconfliction talks with the Russians. From the Israeli perspective, I was in Israel a few weeks ago, and I had this conversation. There's two things, two big things that they're looking at. One is a net positive, potentially, and one is profoundly negative. The net positive is what's going on in Syria, because in Syria you see an Assad regime that is at war with assorted forces, including the Islamic State. The Israelis are not so concerned about the attrition of the Assad regime, but they are seeing a situation where a balkanization of Syria could create a potentially serious strategic problem for them. The current situation worries them only in the tactical context, in the context that they could become accidentally embroiled in the fight, hence the deconfliction talks, and that the Syrian civil war could spill over onto Israel's northern front through the Golan Heights, which is why the Israeli military has reconfigured its deployments, has strengthened its northern command, and so forth. But right now, the Israeli watchword for Syria is to stand very still and hope nobody sees us. Which is, I think, precisely what is going on with regard to the very public outreach between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Putin. The idea here is to make sure that Israel doesn't accidentally do something that changes the conversation. The negative thing that the Israelis are looking at is the Iran deal. There is a plurality of opinion in Israel, but in the main, the vast majority, certainly of the people that I talk to, see the Iran deal as a profoundly negative development and one that is going to have both near-term and long-term consequences. The near-term consequences, what they're looking at is a quantity question. Defense planners that I talked to when I was in Israel are very apprehensive over the idea that once the sanctions relief that's inherent in the JCPOA kicks in earnest, Iran will transfer large quantities of the types of rockets Israel fought last year during the Gaza war with Hamas to groups like Hezbollah, to groups like Hamas. And as a result, Israel is going to be caught in what they call an economic attrition cycle, where it has to spend more and more on defensive capabilities just to maintain the same level of security and of deterrence, which is why I think you're going to see over the next several weeks, as Israeli lawmakers and policymakers come here through town here in Washington, you're going to see requests for additional ramped-up funding for the creation of Iron Dome interceptors, things like that, because that's what they're worried about. Over the long term, they're very concerned about what Iranian militarization, military modernization, Iranian expansionism is going to look like, because all of this is going to be fueled by the Iran deal. This is the profoundly negative subtext through which the Israelis are looking at a region where right now Syria may be the hot button and may be the fastest moving crisis, but it's not necessarily the most negative one for them.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. There is no one else in the queue, so I'm going to turn it back to our moderator.
Okay, we're at 4:26, so I'll ask a last question. Now that Russia's intervened in Syria, are there any indicators or reports to verify if the Saudis have already made earnest moves to acquire nuclear weapons from Pakistan or North Korea?
Well, I think the Saudi acquisition of, purported acquisition or desire to acquire a nuclear weapons from Pakistan is, I think, much more closely linked to Iranian capabilities. And a lot of what the Saudis have been talking about, have been threatening, is keyed to the, I think, very accurate Gulf understanding that the original intent of negotiations with Iran have not been fulfilled. The original intent, of course, was a rollback of Iranian nuclear infrastructure. But the reality is that under the terms of the JCPOA, what Iran gets to keep is a slower but stronger nuclear program. Under the terms, particularly in the annexes of the JCPOA, you have provisions that mean that a decade from now, the Iranians are going to emerge not only with their infrastructure intact, but actually with their nuclear infrastructure strengthened. And so what you're beginning to see, and I think it's going to strengthen over time, is moves by countries like Saudi Arabia with this in mind to shore up their strategic counterweights. These guys understand that the threat of Iranian nuclearization hasn't gone away, it's just slowed down temporarily, and what they're trying to do is they're trying to now speed up to catch up.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you very much. We've reached the end of our time. We're approaching 4:30. The Middle East Forum thanks Ilan Berman for his briefing and to our participants for calling in. And this concludes our conference call.